we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for joining me today. I'm really wanting to follow up on a couple of the phone calls that we got in on Tuesday. I was really inspired by a few of our callers that had talked about how they had just, you know, they never studied history, never studied the Constitution, and recently were given copies of the Constitution, the Declaration, started studying those things, started realizing how important it was to be involved, and then started talking to friends and family about what they were voting for, if they were voting, and if they were voting, then what were they voting for, and why were they voting for those things. And just it was a great reminder of how simple it is for us to solve this civic ignorance problem that is at the heart of all of our problems in the country. I mean, this civic and biblical ignorance, that's the petri dish where bad government grows. And we've allowed that to happen. It's exactly what Ronald Reagan said. He said, I'm warning, this was 45 years ago. He said, I'm warning of an eradication of the American memory that could result in an erosion of the American spirit. So if you lose the memory, if you don't know these things, then you're no longer patriotic. If you don't know how the system works, you're no longer, it's no longer something you're willing to fight for, and no longer something you're willing to defend. And so it's just all the more important for us to get back to the seeds of liberty, to again study these things. So I'm going to do something today that we did, I guess it's been a couple of weeks now, maybe 3 weeks. We dove into Constitution Alive a little bit. We gave you a chance to hear the first week. It was actually a month ago, I guess. But we did the first week of our Constitution Alive class. For those of you that are not familiar, Patriot Academy is a youth leadership program, but it's also now citizenship training for everyone. Spring training, basically. You want to be a good citizen, you go to spring training and you'll have a good season. And so we teach on the Constitution, on leadership, on how the Republic works, how the legislative process works, all of those things. And one of our core products is our Constitution courses. And Constitution Alive is the main course. Now, we have one called Biblical Citizenship that's actually our most popular course. That's the one that's happening all over the country right now, thousands and thousands of classes. But inside Biblical Citizenship is part of Constitution Alive. In other words, I took about half of Constitution Alive, the entire class, and put it inside Biblical Citizenship. It's sort of the meat where the bread on the outside of that meat now in Biblical Citizenship are a lot of interviews and a lot of other folks also participating in that process. All that to say, I want to bring you some more of Constitution Alive here on At the Core, because I think the more we can learn these things, the more we solve the civic and biblical ignorance, the more we're going to be willing to share with others, the better we're going to do at being good citizens. So I'm going to jump back in right now to week two of Constitution Alive, and it's called The Seeds of Liberty. And I think you're going to enjoy this. I think you'll learn a lot today, and it'll be some good things that you can share with your friends and family. So let's jump in. Here's Constitution Alive, The Seeds of Liberty.
Welcome back to the Constitution Alive. We're now going to talk about the seeds of liberty, what the ideas were that these guys actually sowed into our nation, and how it created such a successful nation. And remember that what John Jay told us, our secret formula for how we're going to study the Constitution, he said to make sure that you not only read, but study the Constitution. So if we're going to study it, we've got to get inside the minds of these guys. We've got to know what that original intent. If that's going to be our focus, is original intent, we've got to go back to what these guys actually put in place. I always think it's important not just to study the Constitution, but to study the Declaration with the Constitution. In fact, the founder said you really had to do that. I like the way John Quincy Adams put it. In my language, he said that it was the slab that the home of the Constitution was built upon, the Declaration was. But here's the way he said it. The Declaration of Independence was the platform upon which the Constitution of the United States had been erected. The principles proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence were embodied in the Constitution of the United States. I like the analogy to a business. If you've ever incorporated a business, you got your articles of incorporation, you got your bylaws. Well, your articles of incorporation kind of tell the world, this is what we are, this is who we are, this is what we're about. And then the bylaws are the rules by which that company's going to operate. In this room, they gave us our Articles of Incorporation in the Declaration of Independence, the philosophy of America. It said, here's who we are, what we're about, and what we're going to do. And then the Constitution, that's our bylaws. That's the rules by which our nation operates. That's the rules of our nation. So we like to take them together. And I find it interesting that when you look at them side by side, you find a lot of the grievances in the Declaration of Independence actually solved in the Constitution. Grievances that they said, we're separating from the mother country over this, and we want to make sure that our nation never does the same thing. Now, of course, if you grew up like I did on Saturday morning watching Schoolhouse Rocks, anybody else watching? Okay, I'm the only one in the room. Anyway, Schoolhouse, you know, I'm a Bill, the little guy. Well, in Schoolhouse Rocks, what's the one reason why we declared our independence from Great Britain? What's the one everybody always talks about? Taxation without representation, right? That's the one we all know. 27 reasons. That was like number 17. It's way down on the list. You had religious liberty issues. You had judicial tyranny issues. A lot of things that we're going to raise later tonight. But all of these grievances in the Declaration, so many of them are mentioned in the Constitution. So let's start with the Declaration. And let's go back again to this room and these guys in this room. And actually, let's back up about a month before what we talked about earlier. On June 7th, 1776, Richard Henry Lee, right over here from Virginia, stands up and he makes the motion. He says that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And that's treason. He just committed treason right here in Independence Hall. He committed treason against the mother country. John Adams seconds the motion. Guy taking the journal scratches out both their names because he knows that's the two guys King George is going after right off the bat. They debate it. They talk about it for several days. They talk about should they even consider this? If they do consider it, how should they go about doing it? Talk, talk, talk. Finally, those five guys you see in the middle of the screen, those were the five guys that were given the responsibility for drafting the Declaration of Independence. And immediately you probably recognize Jefferson and Franklin. Franklin's on the right of Jefferson there, and to the far left is Adams. Two guys in the middle there, that's Roger Sherman and Robert Livingston. Livingston actually ended up not getting to sign. Here, he's the guy, the chairman actually, of the committee to write the Declaration, but he gets called away and doesn't get a chance to sign. But anyway, so these guys come back with the Declaration. As you know, Jefferson did all the heavy lifting. In fact, right around the corner, they've rebuilt his apartment there, and they put all these original furnishings back in. It's incredible. You can go in and see the place where he wrote the Declaration of Independence. You can see the things that he wrote it with. It's just phenomenal. But so he drafts it, brings it back in. They debate it here for several days, and they're debating and debating. Finally, one of the guys has had all he can handle. I mean, he's just tired of the talk. He wants some action. He's not a well-known founding father. I think he sat over in this corner over here. His name was Larry, and Larry got up and he said, guys, it's time to get her done. I'm waiting for a ranger to tackle me for saying that, because that did not happen, okay? It wasn't Larry. It was actually John Witherspoon. And it was Witherspoon from New Jersey right here saying, you know, it was kind of a 1776 version of Get Her Done, because John Dickinson had actually said, the people are not ripe for revolution. So Witherspoon gets up and he says, they're not only ripe, but rotting. He said, let's take the vote. They took the vote. The vote failed. He actually had three states that said no initially. South Carolina, Delaware, and Pennsylvania all said no. Now, Delaware was close, man. Delaware was a tie. Delaware was a one-to-one tie, and the third delegate, Caesar Rodney, wasn't here. He had been called back home, a brigadier general. And instantly, Thomas McKean, the yes vote, he knows, man, if Rodney was here, we could get independence. But if Rodney doesn't get back by the time we take the vote again, independence is going to fail. So he sends a dispatch back to Delaware, tells him, find Caesar Rodney, tell Rodney to get back here. We got to have him or independence fails. Rodney gets the message, gets on his horse, takes off, rides all night long. Now, this is 80 miles, right? 80 miles from Delaware back. Now, 80 miles, I know for us, that doesn't sound like much, right? I mean today, 80 miles is, you know, if my wife's driving, that's 30 minutes or so. That's just not going to take that long. But back then, 80 miles on horseback at night, Rodney had cancer of the face. He's hitting branches. It's a painful experience. Rodney gets here, busts through those doors just in time to cast a tie-breaking vote for Delaware. Delaware goes from being a 1-1 tie to being 2-1 for independence. And in fact, Caesar Rodney's pen, the actual quill that he used, is sitting right there on that desk. That's the pen that he used to sign the Declaration of Independence. Well, you say, okay, fine, Rick, that's Rodney. That takes care of Delaware. And by the way, I don't know if you collect the quarters from each state, but if you get the one from Delaware, on the back of that quarter, they chose to put Caesar Rodney. Why? Because of his midnight ride to save independence. So that takes care of Delaware. What about Pennsylvania? Well, Pennsylvania had initially been four of them against independence, three of them for independence. So that means that we lose. This happens in politics all the time. When the opposition is not in the room, take the vote, man. Get the vote done before they get back. Well, that's kind of what happened. Two of your guys against independents. They either left, we don't know for sure if they left, or they just said, we're staying silent and decided not to vote. But Pennsylvania went from being 4-3 against independents to being 3-2 for independents. South Carolina completely flipped their entire vote. And there you have it. That's how close we were to not getting our independents. I don't know about you. I'm not a huge fan of the HBO special on John Adams. I loved the first two episodes, but later I just felt like they portrayed him as just, I don't know, just kind of like a sourpuss, really. I mean, he's always jealous of Washington. He doesn't care about his kids. They never talked about his faith. I mean, I just didn't like the way they ended up portraying it later on. But in those first two episodes, when they portrayed what happened in here, they really captured it, I think. They captured how close these guys were, and you saw kind of the wrangling back and forth and the negotiating. And trying to convince each other of what to do. And it did show, I think, accurately that John Adams was really the force behind the whole thing. I mean, without him, we would have never had independence. But we were very close not to having independence. And not only was independence itself really miraculous in the way that things came together, but the Revolutionary War itself. Throughout the war, you know, Washington and others talked about how the wind came up at just the right time, the fog came in at just the right time. Over and over and over again, they said divine providence intervened on behalf of the Americans. So they brought to life the words of the Declaration. I call the Declaration of Independence, or at least the first two paragraphs, the frame of America. In my mind, in my way of thinking, those were the principles. If you go to that heart of the Declaration, you find the frame for our picture. And you might have a different picture that you would throw up on the screen here, but if you could picture freedom, if you could take some picture of your family or your schools or your community or your churches, whatever it might be, and put that picture inside the frame of America, know this. If that frame goes, then your picture's going with it. My picture's going with it. That frame is what's holding it all together. Those principles they put in place, that's why we're free. And if we lose that frame, if we allow that frame to be destroyed or transformed or changed into something that they didn't give us, then we're going to lose the picture. We're going to have a very different America than we were given. So it's important for us to remember the frame and remember what the principles are in the Declaration of Independence. And I'm going to actually ask for a little bit of help here tonight. I'm going to get one of my sons to come up and share with us those principles out of the Declaration of Independence. He's going to share with you the first two paragraphs, and then he's going to describe what those precious 56 words in the second paragraph, what they really mean and what they gave us in America. So y'all help me welcome Rhett Green. He's going to come up and join us. Come on up, buddy. Come on in. He's even more nervous about crossing this rail than I was. So, all right, Rhett, let's come right back here. There's your spot. Now, you are standing in the very spot where the guys that wrote the language that you're about to share with us, where they debated it, where they came up with it, where they adopted it. So this is a pretty historic occasion. I want you to share the first paragraph where Jefferson actually is telling us, hey, here's why we're going to tell the whole world what we're doing, and then the 56 words, and then give us a little description of those 56 words. Go ahead, buddy.
One of the course of human events becomes necessary for one people to resolve the political band which had connected them to another, to assume in the powers of the earth a separate and equal station, to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitles them. A disrespected opinion of mankind acquires that they should clear the causes that impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, drawing their just power to the consent of the governed. In the words of the Declaration, there are four basic principles that make up the frame of America. First, the Founding Fathers began with the basic idea that truth is real, it is obvious, and it does not change. Second, they made it clear that God is a source of freedom. Like the Declaration says, our rights don't come from any elected or appointed officials, they come from God Almighty. Third, the just powers of government can only come from the consent of the governed. That's you and me. The word consent is used 3 times in the Declaration and 11 times in the Constitution. Obviously, our Founding Fathers didn't want the government's use of power without our consent. They wanted us to always remember, the government's use of power without our consent is tyranny. Now, last part of the frame is the pursuit of happiness. This is the free enterprise system that made America the most successful nation in history. Thomas Jefferson once said, a wise and frugal government that shall lead men free to regulate their own pursuit and industry improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor bread it has earned. This is a sum of good government. Now let's all do our part to preserve those four principles. Welcome back, my dad.
Good job, buddy. Way to go. You take that with you. All right, our 9-year-old scholar on the Declaration of Independence. We got to do something about these shy, poorly socialized homeschoolers, I guess. I don't know.
Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back on At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for staying with me. First segment, we got the beginning of Constitutional Live, week two. As you recall, we did week one, about a month ago, and our callers on Tuesday inspired me to get us a little further into the Constitution. So today we're learning about the seeds of liberty. Right as we were going to break, my son, who was only 9 at the time, was teaching in Independence Hall. Hope you enjoyed that. He was teaching on the Declaration of Independence and those core principles. Let's jump right back in where we left off. Here's Constitution Alive.
So I'm just going to touch on one quick thing about each of those things that Rhett was just sharing with you, because I think it's obvious sometimes when we say it today, truths, that we forget what these guys were comparing that to around the world. In other words, when we say truths today, we mean obviously moral absolutes, a right and wrong, that there is a right and wrong. It's always right to do right, it's always wrong to do wrong. Put yourself back in their shoes and in their day and what those words meant. For instance, George Washington put it this way. He said, "Of all the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." So he's saying that if you're going to have a formula that works, if you're going to have a nation that's successful, of all the pieces of that formula that you put in there, you've got to have religion and morality. And without those two, it's just not going to work. And a lot of my friends are always saying, "Well, Rick, man, I'm into liberty. You know, I'm into freedom, but don't mention God. You know, don't bring the Bible into this. Don't do anything." You know, they don't want any of that. They say, "Hey, I can be a patriot without that." And I say, "Well, yeah, that's probably true, but George Washington would have disagreed. Washington actually said, "In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism that would work to subvert or labor to subvert these great pillars." What pillars? Religion and morality. Why is he saying that? Because when he's given that speech, he's watching the French Revolution take place. So see, the American Revolution was based on the idea of right and wrong and freedom or liberty under God, liberty with God. The French Revolution was the opposite. The French Revolution was liberty without God. It was all about everybody do whatever's right in their own eyes. It's just two different philosophies. Theirs led to chaos. It led to the guillotine. It led to destruction. Ours led to the greatest nation in the history of the world. So there was something special about our formula. And Washington was saying, you can't have liberty without morality. You can't have morality without religion. You got to keep those things in who you are, that God's at the center of our equation of freedom. So as we work to preserve freedom, or as some today say, like Jefferson, you know, that you need a good revolution. In our situation, we just need a freedom revolution. We just need more actions by our citizens, just participating, voting, being a part of the process. We don't have to revolt with bullets. We get to revolt with ballots. What a wonderful system. These guys laid their lives on the line so we wouldn't have to do it that way. So we want revolution. Yes, no question about it. Constantly having a revolution of freedom in our nation. Here's the deal, though. We don't want the French kind, okay? So we don't want to try freedom without God. We want to make sure it's freedom, recognizing there's something bigger than us, that I'm not the end-all be-all, you're not the end-all be-all. I mentioned on the break, my friend Zig Ziglar. Zig told me one time, he said, "Rick, I know three things. I know there is a God, I know I'm not him, and neither are you." Thought I was getting a little too big for my britches, I guess. But so we need to remember that, right? We need to remember that we're not the end-all be-all. And that's, I think, what these guys were saying. It wasn't that you had to worship the same way I do or be of the same faith that I was, but it was a recognition that there is a creator in this equation of freedom. And that's why I think Jefferson had those important words in the Declaration, that we are, in fact, endowed by our Creator, not by our commissioner or our president or our government, but we're endowed by our Creator. And that was a distinction, really. I think what Jefferson was trying to say there was, hey, we're not going to be like Europe or anywhere else on the planet. Because if you were, again, back in their shoes, if you went back to their day, when these guys came in this room in 1776 and adopted this Declaration, Every model of government around the planet was different from what they were putting forth. Every model of government on the whole planet looked kind of like this. It said that power and freedom comes from God, but it goes to the king, it goes to the monarch, and then the monarch decides how much freedom we the people get. So everything in our life really depended upon our relationship to the king. If you didn't have a good relationship, you didn't have much at all. These guys in this room did something nobody had ever done. They flipped that on its head. They totally turned that around. And they said, no, we believe freedom comes from God, no doubt. That's the source of our rights and our source of freedom. But we believe that that freedom from God goes directly to the people. And then we, the people, we give power to government only as we see fit. Just like Rhett was saying, consent of the governed. The only just powers of government come from the consent of the governed. So what Jefferson and these guys put in place was a system that says there's freedom granted by God, there's rights granted, and it goes directly to us, and then we give power to government only for one reason: to protect and secure the freedom that God gave us. So that creates a totally different atmosphere, because if these guys didn't give us our freedom, if government didn't give us our freedom, government can't take it away. If your neighbor is not the one that gave you freedom, then your neighbor can't take it away. See, I love the fact that these guys said there's equal protection for all because it comes from a higher source. And if we take that piece of the puzzle out of the equation, we have no true freedom. We got to keep that peace in. So let's not forget that. And let's make sure that it's liberty under God, not liberty without God. And that didn't change with the Constitution. I mean, that was the philosophy behind the Declaration for sure. But even when they came in and did the Constitution itself, could you imagine the things these guys were fighting about? I mean, they pretty much gave up about 5 weeks into this thing. And here they were debating over, okay, we throw the Articles of Confederation out, we start over, how are we going to sell that to the American people? Big state versus small state, back and forth, back and forth. Oh, finally, people start coming with their plans. They can't seem to find a plan they really agree on. Slavery and the Three-Fifths Compromise, they fought about that for a while. And I always thought when I read that, that a Three-Fifths Compromise, that the Three-Fifths Compromise language was devaluing a human being. That was saying that person was only worth three-fifths of a person. And then I read this guy, Frederick Douglass. I don't know if you've read much of Frederick Douglass, but great abolitionist, amazing guy. I mean, you talk about somebody that God used in a mighty way. I mean, an incredible guy. Read Frederick Douglass. And Douglass said, he thought the same thing. He said, that's devaluing me as a black man. He said, I don't like that. And then he went and he read the debates that took place right here in this room. And he said, when I read those debates, I figured out, no, that was actually the northern states punishing the southern states and saying, hey, if you're going to keep slavery, we're going to decrease your representation in Congress. You're not going to get as many members of Congress as long as you got slavery. Now, once you get rid of slavery and you free everybody, you let everybody vote, you let everybody participate, you let everybody have freedom, you'll get the same amount of representation in Congress that we have. That's what that was all about. But man, they went back and forth, talked about property and what it meant. And you really had some strong anti-slavery guys in here trying to end slavery from the beginning. Obviously, we didn't accomplish that. And it took 100 years and a lot of bloodshed to get it right. But a lot of these guys were on the right side of that argument from day one. So anyway, you had all these fights going on. You get about 5 weeks in, and people started leaving. They just started giving up. Say, it's just not going to happen. We're not going to reach an agreement. And some people started leaving. And so this man right here gets up to save the day. Benjamin Franklin, who sat right here by where I'm talking, the sage, the wise man of the convention, he was 81. 81 when he sat there during those constitutional debates. And I have trouble even wrapping my head around that. I mean, I used to think 81 was old. I don't think that anymore. It's getting younger and younger. In fact, I was with a congressman doing an event a while back, and he had just turned 81. He was my congressman when I was growing up. I mean, when I went to high school, he was my congressman. He's still in Congress, so he's been there a little while. But he had just turned 81 before this event that we were doing, just a week or two before. And so he gets up there to introduce me after he does his thing, and he says, Rick, he said, I bet you think 81's old. He said, let me tell you something. I just turned 81 last week. And he said, I went to Senator Strom Thurmond's 100-year birthday party. He said, at that party, Thurmond looked over at me and said, oh, to be 80 again. So I think 81 today is still young. Wouldn't you agree with that? All right, so 81 today is young. Not for these guys, all right? Average lifespan in their day and time was 35. This guy's 81. He's the elder statesman and probably the most respected guy here. I mean, when he spoke, everybody was going to listen. So he decides he's going to try to save the day. He's going to try to keep this thing going, keep these guys together. Stands up, gives his longest speech of the convention. It's June 28th is when this happens. So June 28th, 1787, right here, he stands up and he says, Mr. President, the small progress we've made after 4 or 5 weeks, close attendance and continual reasons with each other, our different sentiments on almost every question is, methinks, a melancholy proof of the imperfection of the human understanding. Now, look, I'm a country boy, I'll just tell you, from Dripping Springs, Texas, and I have to try to make this stuff work for country boy language. I think what he just said is, we ain't smart enough. He said, we don't have the brain power to solve these huge problems right now. He's saying, even with this brain trust in this room, some of the greatest minds on the planet, we cannot do this on our own, is what he was saying. And so then he goes on to explain what they had been debating about. He said, we indeed seem to feel our own want of political wisdom since we've been running about in search of it. We've gone back to ancient times, to models of government, and examined those different forms of those republics which now no longer exist. They even looked at Europe. But look at the response when they looked at Europe. I love this. He said, we've viewed modern states all around Europe, but find none of their constitutions suitable to our circumstances. I just wish our leaders in Washington would still look to Europe and go, nah, that doesn't work for us. You know, there was a lot of wisdom in this room when they looked at Europe and said, we don't want to be like them, right? We want to be our own. Anyway, so he goes on to say, in this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? So Benjamin Franklin stands up and says to these guys after 5 weeks of debate, hey, time out. We're trying to solve the biggest problems in the world, and we haven't yet gone to God and said, would you please help us out? We can't do this on our own. And so then he gives them a history lesson. And you know, I think it's interesting that only 11 years into being a nation, we needed a history lesson already. I don't know about you. Now, most of you probably loved it. I hated history when I was in high school and college. I had no interest in what happened 200 years ago. You know, I just, you know, I was a kid. I'm kind of a type A person. My wife says I'm type AAA. I mean, I tend to go 100 miles an hour. So I'm thinking about tomorrow, the next year, 100 years from now. I didn't want to think about yesterday. And then I got into law school and I started reading the opinions of these judges. And I realized these judges were really into history because the way that they perceived yesterday determined the decision they made in their decisions in the court. And so then I got into the legislature and all my colleagues in the legislature, I realized, and it finally became apparent, how we each viewed yesterday determined our decisions today and therefore where our state was going in the future. Of course, I also find it interesting in the good book, God says, remember the former days. He talks about studying our history. How many times throughout the Word of God is there constantly a reminder of here's what I was doing here and here's what happened here, constantly looking at history. So I think it is important for us to study history, and that's why I love being here now, and I've fallen in love with history because of how much it influences where we're going. But it's hard for me to imagine. These guys were all there. I mean, they knew what had happened in the Revolutionary War, and yet even though they were there and part of it, Benjamin Franklin had to stand up and give him a history lesson 11 years after what took place in this room for the Declaration. Here's how he put it. He said, in the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. So Franklin says to his colleagues, hey, remember in this room? So he was one of six that signed both the Declaration and the Constitution, kind of like James Wilson, who we talked about earlier. A bunch of these guys weren't there for the Declaration, so he's really reminding them. I think he was speaking to them, and he was saying, hey, you may not have been in here, but let me tell you something. We knew we couldn't do it on our own. So he said, in the beginning, so he takes them back to this room 11 years previous. He said, our prayers were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. Then he asked the same question from right here that I think we need to ask today. He said, have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? I think that's kind of where we are in America. Do we really think we can solve these massive problems that we're dealing with just on our own? Do we think we can do it on our own? Franklin said no more than 200 years ago. I would say no today. So he goes on to say, I've lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs in the affairs of men. You've heard this part, if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? So here we are, they're talking about, can a nation rise? Can they take a constitution and create a successful nation? He's saying, it can't happen without God. He's saying, you can't do it without God. He said, we've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. Then he said something real interesting. He said, I beg mood to leave that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and his blessing on our deliberation be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business. Now why would this guy that, and I would argue out of all the guys, probably the least religious of our founding fathers. In fact, I think, you know, whether you come from a conservative, liberal point of view on the founding fathers, most everybody agrees Ben Franklin was one of our least religious founding fathers. But least has got to be a relative term, because here this least religious founding father, if you're familiar with the Bible at all, you just heard him quote about 11 different scriptures right there in that one short quote. And he's saying, hey, you shouldn't even be trying to do this without God on our side. So here this guy is calling everybody, saying, hey, we got to keep God in the equation. God's an essential part of the equation. And Washington later would write and talk about the fact that he ended up leading everybody here to church. And they went to the church service, and the pastor there actually preached on and talked about and prayed about the fact that what was happening in this room, God needed to move so that they could reach their compromises, get the Constitution out so that we could become that beacon on a hill. And Washington said the attitude really changed when they came back from that, and they were able to work through things. And then once they worked through things, several of these guys looked back on those moments in this room. And they said they believed the hand of God had played a role in what happened in here. Here's Franklin later. He said, I may not be understood to infer that our General Convention was divinely inspired when it formed the new federal Constitution, yet I must own I have so much faith in the general government of the world by providence that I can hardly conceive a transaction of such momentous importance should be suffered to pass without being influenced, guided, and governed by that omnipotent, omnipresent, and beneficent ruler in whom all inferior spirits live and move and have their being. So he's quoting out of Acts right there to describe what he believed happened. James Madison, father of our Constitution. He said, the real wonder is that the Constitutional Convention overcame so many difficulties, and to overcome them with so much agreement was as unprecedented as it was unexpected. It is impossible for the pious man not to recognize in it a finger of that almighty hand which was so frequently extended to us in the critical stages of the Revolution. So they all remembered how throughout the Revolution they saw God move and give them the advantage. I mean, think about it. They were taking on the greatest military on the planet. We were a bunch of rabble-rousers. There was no way we could win if there hadn't been some miraculous thing happens. And he's saying, just like we saw it in the Revolution, we saw it in the Constitutional Convention. Couldn't have happened without God's hand. Alexander Hamilton, same kind of thing. He said, for my own part, I sincerely esteem the Constitution a system which without the finger of God never could have been suggested and agreed upon by such a diversity of interests. And last, the man that sat in that very chair right there, president of the convention, George Washington, father of our country, he said, as to my sentiments with respect to the new Constitution, it appears to me little short of a miracle. It demonstrates as visibly the finger of providence as any possible event in the course of human affairs can ever designate it. It was miraculous, folks. I mean, the fact that these concepts that had never been put together in a governing body, a republic never created like what they put together, I'm saying it never would have happened if God hadn't inspired, if he hadn't made it happen. So I just want to lay that out first before we actually crack open the Constitution itself and get into the words to recognize where these guys got their ideas, where they gave credit to, in fact, who they quoted the most.
All right, folks, another break right here. We'll be back in just a second here on At the Core. If you're interested in taking the full Constitutional Live class, be sure and visit patriotacademy.com today. We'll be right back on At the Core.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to At the Core with Walker Wobbin and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for staying with me today. Final segment for the day. We're going to jump right back in to Constitution Alive with David Barton and Rick Green. This is the original Constitution class Patriot Academy put out several years back. You can get it right now at patriotacademy.com. You can even sign up to be a coach or a host of these classes for free and invite people over to your living room, your church, wherever it might be. Believe me, trust me, I know after 8,000 or more classes that have taken place across the country, what it'll do for you and for the people you bring to your class and for your community as a result of that. So be sure you check it out. All right, let's jump right back in where we left off with Constitution Alive.
Have you ever really kind of looked closely at what these guys were saying? They were students of history. Man, they quoted some of the great minds throughout our history. And I think it's important for us to know those influences. If you haven't read Montesquieu and the Spirit of the Laws and John Locke and his two treatises of government, all that is kind of the background, the big instruction manual, if you will, for this quick start guide. And so they quoted those guys quite a bit. And there was a guy in Houston, Texas, University of Houston, last name of Lutz, that did a study on their quotes, on who they quoted most often. And he took about 15,000 or so writings, I forget the number, and he charted them all, and he put them in a spreadsheet, and he figured out, okay, who did these guys quote the most? And Montesquieu actually ranked number one. He was quoted 8.3% of the time by these guys. So almost, you know, what is that? Almost 10%. I mean, almost one out of 10 times. They're quoting Montesquieu, but Blackstone was a close second. And they quoted Blackstone quite a bit. He was at 7.9%. Locke, I mentioned. Now Locke was probably more influential on the Declaration than on the Constitution, but still very influential. Was it 2.9? I can't see. Yeah, 2.9%. In fact, while we're talking about Locke, I thought it was interesting. that Richard Henry Lee over there from Virginia, when he talked about the Declaration of Independence, he said that Jefferson basically copied the Declaration of Independence from Locke's Two Treatises of Government. Now, that Two Treatises of Government, my copy is a 1764 version. It's about, I think mine's, it's either 404 or 406 pages. That's not a lot, right? I mean, roughly 400 pages. And in those roughly 400 pages, there's about 1,500 references to the Bible, quoting scripture on what government ought to look like. Now, you do the math. That's about 3 to 4 times on every page that John Locke is quoting the Bible, and that's the book that Jefferson copied the Declaration, according to Richard Henry Lee, who was in this room. Now, you'll also find phrase after phrase in the Declaration of Independence that was originally preached by a guy named John Wise. If you ever get a chance to read some of John Wise's sermons, these guys actually reprinted his sermons and put them out for publication because they were like the seeds of liberty. There was so much in there that when sown, man, people would get excited about freedom and they would want to be patriots and want to be part of the revolution. So guys like that were big influence. But here's the most influential source on all these guys in the room. I bet you can guess what it was. It was the Bible. 34% of the time. Man, that's 1 out of 3. They're quoting the Bible. So a lot of people say the Bible didn't have any influence on the Constitution. I would disagree completely. If you read these guys, who they quoted, the phrases in the Constitution, they trace back to the Constitution, to the Bible. I mean, it's just over and over and over again. So the idea, just in summary, of truths out of the Declaration, the Creator being the source of our freedom, those were important concepts from the philosophy laid down in the Declaration before they even came to the Constitution itself. And the last thing I'll comment on what Rhett had said about the pursuit of happiness, just give you a quick example on this whole free enterprise thing for America, why these guys knew that the pursuit of happiness was important, why free enterprise was a bedrock principle of our way of life. You got to remember, as students of history, they were looking back to how things first started here on this continent. And you might remember Bradford tried socialism in the beginning with the Pilgrims. And actually, it didn't work out so well. Now, it was socialism. I mean, Karl Marx would have loved this. The way they did it was they said, everybody's going to work. Whatever you work for and the food you grow, you're going to put it in the public storehouse. And then everybody gets to take from it as they need it. Oh, and we'll all love each other and we'll hold hands and sing Kumbaya. And it sounded great, right? Well, what happened? Bradford said it was terrible. It didn't work at all. He said, guys like me, I'd have been over there saying, hey, why should I work? I get all the food I want. I'm going to play golf. I mean, I don't think they play golf back then, but whatever you do with the Pilgrims, I'm going to go play some games. Anyway, so he said, Bradford actually said people started faking being sick. They were actually faking illness. They were not working and they were complaining. The ones that were working complained and said, hey, man, Green's over there not working. I'm feeding his family. Why didn't... So here's what he said. He said, community of property was found to breed much confusion and discontent. So what was his solution? What did Bradford implement that we actually, these guys here, said was so important? Free enterprise and private property. Imagine that. He said, okay, everybody, you get your own property. You can grow stuff on that property, and then you can eat it, or you can sell it. You can do whatever you want with it. It's totally up to you. And within 2 years, those guys were exporting corn instead of starving to death. Free enterprise, private property, it worked, and these guys knew it. Here's how Bradford described it afterwards. He said, it made all hands very industrious, so that much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been by any means the governor or any other could devise, and saved him a great deal of trouble and gave far better satisfaction. So in other words, that system worked, and these guys knew that, and that's why they put it into our system in the pursuit of happiness. Now, here's where we come in. We are the governed, right? So it requires our consent for our system to work. If we want just power in our government, then we've got to give our consent. I like James Garfield. President Garfield was a pastor and also president of the United States, and he put it this way. He said, now more than ever before, the people are responsible for the character of their Congress. He said, if that body be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt... Don't be hollering out any congressman's name, okay? If that body be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, I know we all pictured somebody, but if it be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, it's because the people tolerate ignorance, recklessness, and corruption. He said if it be intelligent, brave, and pure, it's because the people, I like this word, demand these high qualities to represent them in the national legislature. If the next centennial does not find us a great nation, it'll be because the people who represent the enterprise, the culture, and the morality of the nation. That's us. That's the people in this room now, the people at home watching, people watching on the DVD. We are the enterprise, the culture, and the morality of the nation. He said, if we don't have a great nation, it's because those people did not aid in controlling the political forces. Now, controlling there simply means giving or refusing our consent, exercising our freedoms, living out the Constitution and the Declaration. Last quote on this. One of the guys in this room, John Francis Mercer, he actually told us that this document right here is not enough. That what they were framing would not be enough to guarantee freedom. In fact, he said it's a great mistake to suppose the paper we are to propose will govern the United States. He said the Constitution will not govern the United States. Say, wait a minute, I thought we came here to study the Constitution because it's governing the United States. He said, no, it's the men whom it will bring into the government. See, it's going to set up the rules for how we choose our leaders and how they're supposed to govern. So it does set up the rules, but it's not going to govern us. It's the men whom it will bring into the government and the interest they have in maintaining it that will govern them. The paper will only mark out the mode and the form, kind of like that frame. Men are the substance and must do the business. What he's saying is this document's great. But if we, the people, put people in office and on the bench that are willing to ignore it, willing to shred it, willing to distort it, willing to govern around it, it just doesn't mean anything anymore. The document doesn't govern us. The people we put into government is what governs us. So if we want to uphold this document, then we have to make wise decisions in choosing our leaders. We have to be part of the process even as it goes on, even after you choose the leaders. Being engaged in our government, watching what's happening, letting our voice be heard constantly, just like these guys did in their lifetime. So that's the philosophy that they gave us. There is a God. There are truths. There's right and wrong worth fighting for, worth dying for. Our system of government will work if we'll just be willing to give or refuse that consent. Being engaged will make those seeds of liberty spring forth. They'll give us a great nation of freedom. So now that we know the seeds of liberty, now that we know how we're going to do this, we're going to dive into the Constitution itself. When we come back in our next section, we're going to do kind of a 30,000 feet view, if you will. We're going to step back and look at the entire Constitution all at once, and then we'll start zooming into specific areas that are most under attack or most in question today. Sort of like our quick start guide, we're going to look for those places we need to be plugging things in and making sure that they work. So when we come back, we'll talk about that 30,000 feet view.
Establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare.
Well, I guess you could tell Rhett was having as much fun as you and I have.
Well, so were you in the background watching Rhett, so you had a lot of fun too.
We love teaching those principles from that very room. Now, before we get to the 30,000 feet view.
And by the way, I think that was the third thing, was to teach the rising generation. I think that's the third objective.
There you go, getting those little guys in there. That is the rising generation. So in our next chapter, we'll get the 30,000 feet view on the Constitution itself. But before we do that, some more on these seeds of liberty. Yeah. Rhett was doing a little bit. He did four principles out of the Declaration.
If you look at the Declaration of Independence, those rights set forth in the Declaration, historians have documented that every single right set forth in the Declaration of Independence had been preached from the American pulpit prior to 1763. The Declaration of Independence is nothing more than listening to the sermons we've been hearing
in
church.
The church was not applying government principles to our life. The church was applying the Bible, and that got reflected in our government principles. So if it was getting taught from the pulpit, it showed up in our government documents.
This guy right here, a guy named John Wise. John Wise, historians like Clinton Roster, and actually Cornell University, he was such a great historian, award-winning historian, that they have an endowed chair of history, the Clinton Roster Chair of History, a great historian. And he went back and said, you know, the American thinking was so different. No other nation did what we did. France didn't do it. Spain didn't do it. Portugal, Italy, no other nation.
So he had to be wondering why.
Why?
Why would we do something different?
And his question, what were the six greatest intellectual forces in shaping the thinking of the founders? He went through and identified six greatest, and four of the six were preachers, and he was one of them. This guy right here, now these are his sermons from 1710 and 1717, and you'll find that by 1680, now he's a preacher in Massachusetts, you'll find by 1680, he had looked through the Bible, and he preaches a sermon. Well, looking at government in the Bible, it's very clear that God's preferred form of government is the consent of the governed. I think I've heard that phrase before. He looks through here and he says...
This was when?
This is 1680s.
So this is 100 years before.
1680s.
And he's already talking about consent of the governed. Okay.
And 100 years before, he says, you know, there is a creator, and he's created all men equal, and he's given them all the same set of rights.
Wow.
1680s. And he goes and he says, when you look at what the Bible says about taxation, it is very clear that taxation without representation is tyranny.
No kidding.
Right here.
So this is, I mean, when we say seeds of liberty, he was literally planting 100 years before what would bear fruit.
That's it.
Well, in our founding document.
Let me show you how significant this was, because he did this in 1680s. tell me what the date of publication of that is right down there.
Oh, I have to read Roman numerals. This is going to be difficult. Okay, so this is 17...
72.
Is it 72? I was going to say 52. So that's 72. Okay, so 17. So the founders then, in their era.
You know who the Sons of Liberty are?
Yeah.
All right. Who are the great Sons of Liberty?
So that was Sam Adams started
Sam
it, right?
Sam Adams and John Hancock and James Otis and all those guys' sons. They're the ones who
reprinted his sermons
and distributed across America so Americans would know how to think going into this conference.
Okay, so wait. So these are sermons preached 100 years before the Declaration. The founders themselves reprinted his sermons,
Sons of Liberty,
to help educate their generation,
to get them thinking on right principles.
So, okay, this gives me great hope, because that means if they did it, if they could do this 200 and whatever years ago, reprint, re-educate, bring these things back to light, then we can do the same thing today.
Absolutely.
We bring these documents out. We
That's
educate
right.
a generation. They come back to these principles. We
and,
bring
and,
them.
And remember that principle number one, and it's demonstrated through here, but principle number one of the Declaration, there is a Creator. And if you don't recognize the Creator, then you got trouble. Now, this is the other thing we get today. The Founding Fathers, atheist, agnostic, deist. Really? You know, let me take something right here. This is, you tell me, what's the name at the bottom of this thing?
George Washington.
George Washington. This is his first ever call to prayer in America at the federal government. That is Washington's.
1789.
This is going to be October the 17th, 1789. He calls the entire nation to honor God. Now, why would Washington do that? He gives the answer right here in this first paragraph. Let me just put it up. I'll show you what's in this first paragraph. Washington is now calling the nation to honor God. Why would he do it? He says, it's the duty. And notice the word duty. That's a word that is a big, important word. We don't talk about it much today. Military yeah. still gets it. A lot of the rural people know what duty means. I built houses for a long time. I had hundreds of thousands of dollars change hands. I never signed a contract in my life. I'd walk into the bank guy. We would talk about the terms. We would shake hands on it. Neither one of us would break that contract. That you have a duty to keep your word.
Yeah.
I don't need it on paper. I've got a duty.
And today so that, you hear duty and people think, oh, responsibility. I don't want that. Yeah.
See, duty in his day is a legally binding contractual obligation. In 1913, the definition of duty was reduced to a responsibility, and today's dictionary says it's that which one ought to do. Well, that's not the same.
It's a choice. Sounds like a choice.
A choice.
Instead of this is what you do.
So what he's saying, it's a legally binding contractual obligation of who? Of nations. Legally binding contractual obligations of nations to do four things concerning God. Number one, to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God. Number two, to obey His will. Number three, to be grateful for His benefits. Number four, humbly to implore His protection and favor. And that's what nations are supposed to do, not individuals. So they believe this philosophy that you have to honor and recognize God as a culture.
But this is just the father of the country.
He's one of the great deist founding fathers, which is what we're told in school
today.
But he's
obligating the nation.
He's obligating
the nation,
not individuals. The nation has
So all this stuff about official acts and, oh, you can keep your religion at home and you can talk about God, but don't even have a public day of prayer. Remember when our governor, Rick Perry, couldn't even pray with people in Houston?
Yeah, because he got together.
Because he's governor, he's not allowed to pray with people because it's official. Exactly what we want is official prayer.
See that? What's that?
Proclamation for Thanksgiving.
It's handwritten. It's done by a guy named John Langdon. Oh, he's the governor. Oh, wait a minute. He's the signer of the Constitution.
Constitution, yeah.
So what do you mean a governor can't have prayer? Here's a governor who's
there
a signer
go.
Of the Constitution. So the signer of the Constitution thought it was the right thing. You've also got Samuel Huntington. There's a signer of the Declaration. He's a call to prayer. He's now governor of his state. He calls the people to
prayer.
So this
is an official act.
An official
from
act.
From a governor.
Here's one from Oliver Wolcott, another signer of the Declaration, another governor of his state calling people to prayer. Here's one from John Langdon, governor of state. Now this is, you know, that was handwritten. This is called a broadside because they would nail these up to trees or they nail these up the side of barns.
And I wish we weren't out of time, but we are. That's all the time we got today. More Constitutional Live maybe next week, or go to patriotacademy.com to get some more. Thanks so much for listening to At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green.
Preborn celebrates that Roe versus Wade has been overturned. Roe has been responsible for the slaughter of over 63 million babies. Now the decision to abort a child will be left in the hands of the states, and sadly, abortions will continue in the most liberal states. Over the past 16 years, Preborn has positioned their clinics in the top abortion cities where 50% of abortions occur. Preborn's work of saving babies' lives continues at an even greater level as they save babies' lives and defend their centers from the radical hate groups who want to shut them down. Preborn's response is dependent on you, the pro-life community. Be a part of rescuing lives and changing hearts for Christ. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and $140 will help to rescue five babies' lives. Dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or go to preborn.com. All gifts are tax deductible.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.